Bill diverted her with a spicy ward rumor. Jill sent the exposed wire by mail, as the postal system seemed safer than a cloak-and-dagger ruse. But her attempts to insert a third spool, she muffed. She waited for the patient to be asleep, but had just mounted the chair when the patient woke.
"Oh, hello, Miss Boardman."
Jill froze.
"Hello, Mrs. Fritchley," she managed to answer. "Have a nice nap?"
"Fair,"
the woman answered peevishly.
"My back aches."
"I'll rub it."
"Doesn't help." "Why are you always fiddling in my closet? Is something wrong?"
Jill tried to re-swallow her stomach.
"Mice," she answered.
"Mice? Oh, I'll have to have another room."
Jill tore the instrument loose and stuffed it into her pocket. Jumped down.
Now, Mrs. Fritchley, I was just looking to see if there were mouse holes. There aren't."
"You're sure?"
"Quite sure.
Now let's rub the back.
Easy over."
Jill decided to risk the empty room, which was part of K-12, the suite of the man from Mars. She got the pass key. Only to find the room unlocked, and holding two more Marines, the guard had been doubled. One looked around as she opened the door. "Looking for someone?"
"No. Don't sit on the bed, boys," she said crisply. "If you need chairs, we'll send for them."
The guard got reluctantly up. She left, trying to conceal her trembling. The bug was still in her pocket when she went off duty. She decided to return it to Caxton. Once in the air and headed toward Ben's apartment, she breathed easier. She phoned him in flight.
"Caxton speaking."
"Jill, Ben, I want to see you."
He answered slowly.
"I don't think it's smart."
"Ben, I've got to. I'm on my way."
"Well, okay, if that's how it's got to be."
"Such enthusiasm."
"Now look, hon, it isn't that I..."
"Bye."
She switched off, calmed down, and decided not to take it out on Ben. They were playing out of their league. At least she was. She should have left politics alone. She felt better when she snuggled into his arms.
Ben was such a dear. Maybe she should marry him.
When she tried to speak, he put a hand over her mouth, whispered,
"Don't talk. I may be wired."
She nodded, got out the recorder, handed it to him. His eyebrows went up, but he made no comment. Instead, he handed her a copy of the Afternoon Post.
"Seen the paper?" he said in a natural voice. "You might glance at it while I wash up."
"Thanks."
As she took it, he pointed to a column, then left, taking with him the recorder. The column was Ben's own. "The Crow's Nest" by Ben Caxton. Everyone knows that jails and hospitals have one thing in common. They can be very hard to get out of. In some ways, a prisoner is less cut off than a patient. A prisoner can send for his lawyer, demand a fair witness, invoke habeas corpus, and require the jailer to show cause in open court. But it takes only a no-visitors sign, ordered by one of the medicine men of our peculiar tribe, to consign a hospital patient to oblivion more thoroughly than ever was the man in the iron mask. To be sure, the patient's next of kin cannot be kept out. But the man from Mars seems to have no next of kin. The crew of the ill-fated Envoy had few ties on Earth. If the man in the iron mask, pardon me, I mean the man from Mars, has any relative guarding his interests, a few thousand reporters have been unable to verify it. Who speaks for the man from Mars? Who ordered an armed guard placed around him? What is his dread disease that no one may glimpse him nor ask him a question? I address you, Mr. Secretary General. The explanation about physical weakness and G-fatigue won't wash. If that were the answer, a 90-pound nurse would do as well as an armed guard. Could this disease be financial in nature? Or, let's say it softly, is it political? There was more of the same. Jill could see that Ben was baiting the administration, trying to force them into the open. She felt that Caxton was taking serious risk in challenging the authorities, but she had no notion of the size of the danger, nor what form it might take. She thumbed through the paper. It was loaded with stories on the champion, pictures of Secretary General Douglas pinning medals, interviews with Captain Van Tromp and his brave company, pictures of Martians and Martian cities. There was little about Smith, merely a bulletin that he was improving slowly from the effects of his trip. Ben came out and dropped sheets of onion skin in her lap.
"Here's another newspaper."
He left again. Jill saw that the newspaper was a transcription of what her first wire had picked up. It was marked, first voice, second voice, and so on. But Ben had written in names wherever he had been able to make attributions. He had written across the top, "All voices are masculine." Most items merely showed that Smith had been fed, washed, massaged, and that he had exercised under supervision of a voice identified as Dr. Nelson and one marked Second Doctor. One passage had nothing to do with care of the patient. Jill reread it. Dr. Nelson, how are you feeling, boy? Strong enough to talk? Smith, yes. Dr. Nelson, a man wants to talk to you. Smith, pause. Who? Caxton had written, all of Smith's speeches are preceded by pauses. Nelson, this man is our great, untranscribable guttural word, Martian. He is our oldest old one. Will you talk with him? Smith, very long pause. I am great happy. The old one will talk, and I will listen and grow. Nelson, no, no, he wants to ask you questions. Smith, I cannot teach an old one. Nelson, the old one wishes it. Will you let him ask you questions? Smith, yes. Background noises. Nelson, this way, sir. I have Dr. Mahmood standing by to translate. Jill read, new voice. Caxton had scratched this out and written in, Secretary General Douglas, 3 exclamation points. Secretary General,
I won't need him. You say Smith understands English?
Nelson, well, yes and no, Your Excellency. He knows a number of words, but as Mahmood says, he doesn't have any cultural context to hang them on. It can be confusing. Secretary General,
oh, we'll get along, I'm sure. When I was a youngster, I hitchhiked all through Brazil without a word of Portuguese when I started. Now, if you will introduce us, then leave us alone.
Nelson,
sir,
I had better stay with my patient. Secretary General,
really, doctor? I'm afraid I must insist. Sorry.
Nelson.
And I'm afraid that I must insist. Sorry, sir. Medical ethics.
Secretary General, interrupting.
As a lawyer, I know something of medical jurisprudence, so don't give me that medical ethics mumbo-jumbo. Did this patient select you?
Nelson.
Not exactly. But,
Secretary General, has he had the opportunity to choose physicians?
I doubt it. His status is ward of the state. I am acting as next of kin de facto, and you will find de jure as well. I wish to interview him alone.
Nelson, long pause, then very stiffly.
If you put it that way, Your Excellency, I withdraw from the case.
Secretary General,
don't take it that way, doctor. I'm not questioning your treatment. But you wouldn't try to keep a mother from seeing her son alone now, would you? Are you afraid I might hurt him?
Nelson.
No, but...
Secretary General.
Then what is your objection? Come now, introduce us and let's get on with it. The fussing may be upsetting your patient.
Nelson.
Your Excellency, I will introduce you. Then you must select another doctor for your... ward.
Secretary General.
I'm sorry, doctor, I really am. I can't take that as final. We'll discuss it later. Now, if you please.
Nelson.
Step over here, sir. Son, this is the man who wants to see you, our great old one.
Smith. Untranscribable. Secretary General.
What did he say?
Nelson.
A respectful greeting. Mahmood says it translates. I am only an egg. More or less that, anyway. It's friendly. Son, talk man talk.
Smith?
Yes.
Nelson?
And you had better use simple words if I may offer a last advice.
Secretary General?
Oh, I will.
Nelson?
Goodbye, Your Excellency.
Goodbye, son.
Secretary General?
Thanks, Doctor. See you later.
Secretary General continued.
How do you feel?
Smith.
Feel fine.
Secretary General.
Good. Anything you want, just ask for it. We want you to be happy. Now I have something I want you to do for me. Can you write?
Smith.
Write. What is write?
Secretary General.
Well, your thumbprint will do. I want to read a paper to you. This paper has a lot of lawyer talk, but stated simply, it says you agree that in leaving Mars, you have abandoned, I mean, given up any claims that you may have there. Understand me? You assign them in trust to the government.
Smith, no answer.
Secretary General, well, let's put it this way. You don't own Mars, do you?
Smith,
longish pause.
I do not understand.
Secretary General, let's try again. You want to stay here, don't you?
Smith, I do not know. I was sent by the old ones.
Long, untranscribable speech. Sounds like a bullfrog fighting a cat. Secretary General,
damn it, they should have taught him more English by now. See here, son, you don't have to worry. Just let me have your thumbprint at the bottom of this page. Let me have your right hand. No, don't twist around that way. Hold still. I'm not going to hurt you. Doctor! Dr. Nelson!
Second doctor.
Yes, sir?
Secretary General.
Get Dr. Nelson.
Second doctor.
Dr. Nelson? But he left, sir. He said you took him off the case.
Secretary General.
Nelson said that? Damn him. Well, do something. Give him artificial respiration. Give him a shot. Don't just stand there. Can't you see the man is dying?
Second doctor.
I don't believe there's anything to be done, sir. Just let him alone until he comes out of it. That's what Dr. Nelson always did.
Secretary General.
Blast Dr. Nelson.
The Secretary General's voice did not appear again, nor that of Dr. Nelson. Jill could guess, from gossip she had picked up, that Smith had gone into one of his cataleptiform withdrawals. There were two more entries. One read, "No need to whisper, he can't hear you." The other read, "Take that tray away. We'll feed him when he comes out of it." Jill was rereading it when Ben reappeared. He had more onion skin sheets, but he did not offer them. Instead, he said,
"Hungry?"
"Starved."
"Let's go shoot a cow."
He said nothing while they went to the roof and took a taxi, still kept quiet during the flight to Alexandria platform where they switched cabs. Ben picked one with a Baltimore number. Once in the air, he set it for Hagerstown, Maryland. Then relaxed.
"Now we can talk."
"Ben, why the mystery?"
"Sorry, Prettyfoots. I don't know that my apartment is bugged, but if I can do it to them, they can do it to me. Likewise, while it isn't likely that a cab signaled from my flat would have an ear in it, still it might have. The special service squads are thorough. But this cab," he patted its cushions, "they can't gimmick thousands of cabs. One picked at random should be safe."
Jill shivered. "Ben, you don't think they would..." She let it trail off.
"Don't I now? You saw my column. I filed that copy 9 hours ago. You think the administration will let me kick it in the stomach without kicking back?"
"But you have always opposed this administration."
"That's okay. This is different. I have accused them of holding a political prisoner.
Jill, a government is a living organism. Like every living thing, its prime characteristic is the instinct to survive. You hit it, it fights back."
"This time I've really hit it," he added. "But I shouldn't have involved you."
"I'm not afraid. Not since I turned that gadget back to you."
"You're associated with me. If things get rough, that could be enough."
Jill shut up. The notion that she, who had never experienced worse than a spanking as a child, and an occasional harsh word as an adult, could be in danger, was hard to believe. As a nurse, she had seen the consequences of ruthlessness, but it could not happen to her. Their cab was circling for a landing before she broke the moody silence. "Ben, suppose this patient dies. What happens?"
"Huh?"
He frowned.
"That's a good question. If there are no other questions, class is dismissed."
"Don't be funny."
"Jill, I've been awake nights trying to answer that. Here are the best answers I have. If Smith dies, his claim to Mars vanishes. Probably the group the champion left on Mars starts a new claim, and almost certainly the administration worked out a deal before they left Earth. The champion is a Federation ship, but it is possible that such a deal leaves all strings in the hands of Secretary General Douglas. That could keep him in power a long time. On the other hand, it might mean nothing at all."
"Huh? Why?"
"The Larkin decision might not apply. Luna was uninhabited, but Mars is, by Martians. At the moment, Martians are a legal zero, but the High Court might take a look at the political situation and decide that human occupancy meant nothing on a planet inhabited by non-humans. Then rights on Mars would have to be secured from the Martians."
"But, Ben, that would be the case anyhow. This notion of a single man owning a planet, it's fantastic."
"Don't use that word to a lawyer.
straining at gnats and swallowing camels is a required course in law schools. Besides, there is precedent. In the 15th century, the Pope deeded the Western Hemisphere to Spain and Portugal, and nobody cared that the real estate was occupied by Indians with their own laws, customs, and property rights. His grant was effective, too. Look at a map and notice where Spanish is spoken and where Portuguese is spoken.
Yes, but, Ben, this isn't the 15th century.
It is to a lawyer, Jill. If the High Court rules that the Larkin decision applies, Smith is in a position to grant concessions which may be worth millions, more likely billions. If he assigns his claim to the administration, then Secretary Douglas controls the plums.
Ben, why should anybody want that much power?
Why does a moth fly toward light? But Smith's financial holdings are almost as important as his position as nominal King Emperor of Mars. The High Court could knock out his squatter's rights, but I doubt if anything could shake his ownership of the Lyell Drive and a chunk of Lunar Enterprises. What happens if he dies? 1,000 alleged cousins would pop up, of course, but the Science Foundation has fought off such money-hungry vermin for years. It seems possible that, if Smith dies without a will, his fortune reverts to the state.
Do you mean the Federation or the United States?
Another question to which I have no answer. His parents come from two countries of the Federation, and he was born outside them all. And it will make a crucial difference to some people who votes that stock and licenses those patents. It won't be Smith. He won't know a stock proxy from a traffic ticket. It is likely to be whoever can grab him and hang on. I doubt if Lloyd's would insure his life. He strikes me as a poor risk.
The poor baby. The poor, poor infant.
Chapter 6. The restaurant in Hagerstown had atmosphere. Tables scattered over a lawn leading down to a lake, and more tables in the boughs of three enormous trees. Jill wanted to eat in a tree, but Ben bribed the maitre d'hotel to set up a table near the water, then ordered a stereo tank placed by it. Jill was miffed.
Ben, why pay these prices if we can't eat in the trees and have to endure that horrible jitterbox?
Patience, little one. Tables in trees have microphones. They have to have them for service. This table is not gimmicked, I hope, as I saw the waiter take it from a stack. As for the tank, not only is it un-American to eat without stereo, but the racket will interfere with a directional mic, if Mr. Douglas's investigators are taking an interest.
Do you really think they're shadowing us, Ben?
Jill shivered.
I'm not cut out for a life of crime.
Pish, and likewise tush. When I was on the General Synthetic scandals, I never slept twice in one place and ate nothing but packaged food. You get to like it. Stimulates the metabolism.
My metabolism doesn't need it. All I require is one elderly, wealthy patient.
Not going to marry me, Jill?
After my future husband kicks off, yes. Or maybe I'll be so rich I can keep you as a pet.
How about starting tonight?
After he kicks off.
During the dinner, the musical show, which had been banging their eardrums, stopped. An announcer's head filled the tank. He smiled and said, NWNW, New World Networks, and its sponsor, Wise Girl Malthusian Lozenges, is honored to surrender time for a history-making broadcast by the Federation government. Remember, friends, every wise girl uses Wise Girls. Easy to carry, pleasant to take, guaranteed no fail, and approved for sale without prescription under Public Law 1312. Why take a chance on old-fashioned, unaesthetic, harmful, unsure methods? Why risk losing his love and respect? The lovely lupine announcer glanced aside and hurried the commercial. I give you the wise girl, who in turn brings you the Secretary General. The 3D picture cut to a young woman, so sensuous, so mammalian, so seductive, as to make any male unsatisfied with local talent. She stretched and wiggled and said in a bedroom voice,
I always use Wise Girl.
The picture dissolved and an orchestra played Hail to Sovereign Peace. Ben said, Do you use Wise Girl?
None of your business.
Jill looked ruffled and added, It's a quack nostrum.
Anyhow, what makes you think I need it?
Caxton did not answer. The tank had filled with the fatherly features of Secretary General Douglas.
Friends, he began, fellow citizens of the Federation, I have tonight a unique honor and privilege, since the triumphant return of our trailblazing champion.
He continued to congratulate the citizens of Earth on their successful contact with another planet, another race. He managed to imply that the exploit was the personal accomplishment of every citizen, that any one of them could have led the expedition had he not been busy with serious work, and that he, Secretary Douglas, had been their humble instrument to work their will. The notions were never stated baldly, the assumption being that the common man was the equal of anyone, and better than most, and that good old Joe Douglas embodied the common man. Even his must cravat and cowlicked hair had a just folks quality. Ben Caxton wondered who had written it. Jim Sanforth, probably. Jim had the slickest touch of any of Douglas's staff in selecting loaded adjectives to tickle and soothe. He had written commercials before he went into politics and had no compunctions. Yes, that bit about the hand that rocks the cradle was Jim's work. Jim was the type who would entice a young girl with candy. "Turn it off," Jill demanded. "Quiet, pretty foots. I must hear this."
"And so, friends, I have the honor to bring you our fellow citizen, Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars. Mike, we know you are tired and have not been well, but will you say a few words to your friends?"
The stereo scene cut to a semi-close of a man in a wheelchair. Hovering over him was Douglas, and on the other side was a nurse, stiff, starched, and photogenic. Jill gasped. Ben whispered, "Keep quiet." The smooth baby face of the man in the chair broke into a shy smile. He looked at the camera and said, "Hello, folks. Excuse me for sitting down. I'm still weak." He seemed to speak with difficulty, and once the nurse took his pulse. In answer to questions from Douglas, he paid compliments to Captain Van Tromp and his crew, thanked everyone for his rescue, and said that everyone on Mars was terribly excited over contact with Earth, and that he hoped to help in welding friendly relations between the two planets. The nurse interrupted, but Douglas said gently,
"Mike, do you feel strong enough for one more question?"
"Sure, Mr. Douglas. If I can answer it."
"Mike, what do you think of the girls here on Earth?"
"Gee."
The baby face looked awestruck and ecstatic and turned pink. The scene cut to head and shoulders of the Secretary Douglas.
"Mike asked me to tell you," he went on in fatherly tones, "that he will be back to see you as soon as he can. He has to build up his muscles, you know. Possibly next week, if the doctors say he is strong enough."
The scene shifted to wise girl lozenges, and a playlet made clear that a girl who did not use them was not only out of her mind, but a syntho in the hay. Men would cross the street to avoid her. Ben switched channels, then turned to Jill and said moodily,
"Well, I can tear up tomorrow's column. Douglas has him under his thumb."
"Ben."
"Huh?"
"That's not the man from Mars."
"What? Baby, are you sure?"
"Oh, it looked like him, but he was not the patient I saw in that guarded room."
Ben pointed out that dozens of persons had seen Smith. Guards, interns, male nurses, the captain and crew of the Champion, probably others. Quite a few of them must have seen this newscast. The administration would have to assume that some of them would spot a substitution. It did not make sense. Too great a risk. Jill simply stuck out her lower lip and insisted that the person on stereo was not the patient she had met. Finally, she said angrily,
"Have it your own way. Men."
"Now, Jill,
please take me home."
Ben went for a cab. He did not order one from the restaurant, but selected one from the landing flat of a hotel across the way. Jill remained chilly on the flight back. Ben got out the transcripts and reread them. He thought a while and said,
"Jill."
"Yes, Mr. Caxton."
"Oh, Mr. You. Look, Jill, I apologize. I was wrong."
"And what leads you to this conclusion?"
He slapped the papers against his palm.
"This. Smith could not have shown this behavior yesterday, and then given that interview tonight. He would have flipped his controls, gone into one of those trance things."
"I am gratified that you have finally seen the obvious."
"Jill, will you kindly kick me, then let up?" "Do you know what this means?"
"It means they used an actor to fake it. I told you an hour ago."
"Sure, an actor and a good one, carefully typed and coached. But it implies more than that. As I see it, there are two possibilities. The first is that Smith is dead, and..."
"Dead?"
Jill was suddenly back in that curious water-drinking ceremony, and felt the strange, warm, unworldly flavor of Smith's personality. Felt it with unbearable sorrow. Maybe. In which case, this ringer will stay alive as long as they need him. Then the ringer will die, and they will ship him out of town with a hypnotic injunction so strong he would choke up with asthma if he tried to spill it. Or maybe even a lobotomy. But if Smith is dead, we can forget it. We'll never prove the truth. So let's assume he's alive.
Oh, I hope so.
What is Hecuba to you, or you to Hecuba? Caxton misquoted. If he is alive, it could be that there's nothing sinister about it. After all, public figures do use doubles. Perhaps in 2 or 3 weeks our friend Smith will be in shape to stand the strain of public appearance. Then they will trot him out. But I doubt it like hell.
Why?
Use your head. Douglas has already failed one attempt to squeeze out of Smith what he wants, but Douglas can't afford to fail, so I think he will bury Smith deeper than ever. And we will never see the true man from Mars.
Kill him?
Jill said slowly. Why be rough? Lock him in a private nursing home and never let him learn anything.
Oh, dear. Then what are we going to do?
Caxton scowled. They own the bat and ball and are making the rules, but I am going to walk in with a fair witness and a tough lawyer and demand to see Smith. Maybe I can drag it into the open.
I'll be right behind you.
Like mischief, you will. As you pointed out, it would ruin you professionally.
But you need me to identify him.
Face to face, I can tell a man who was raised by non-humans from an actor pretending to be such. But if anything goes wrong, you are my ace in the hole. A person who knows that they are pulling hanky-panky and has access to the inside of Bethesda Center. Honey, if you don't hear from me, you are on your own.
Then they wouldn't hurt you.
I'm fighting out of my weight, youngster.
Then I don't like this. Look, if you get in to see him, what are you going to do?
I'll ask him if he wants to leave the hospital. If he says yes, I'm going to invite him to come with me. In the presence of a fair witness, they won't dare stop him.
Then what? He does need medical attention, Ben. He's not able to take care of himself.
Caxton scowled again. I've been thinking of that. I can't nurse him. We could put him in my flat.
And I could nurse him. We'll do it, Ben.
Slow down. Douglas would pull some rabbit out of his hat and Smith would go back to Pokey. And so would both of us, maybe.
He wrinkled his brow.
I know one man who might get away with it.
Who?
Ever heard of Jubal Harshaw?
Huh? Who hasn't?
That's one of his advantages. Everybody knows who he is. It makes him hard to shove around. Being both a doctor of medicine and a lawyer, he is 3 times as hard to shove. But most important, he is so rugged and individualist that he would fight the whole Federation with just a pocket knife if it suited him, and that makes him 8 times as hard. I got acquainted with him during the disaffection trials. He is a friend I can count on. If I can get Smith out of Bethesda, I'll take him to Harshaw's place in the Poconos. And then just let those jerks try to grab him. Between my column and Harshaw's love for a fight, we'll give him a bad time.
Chapter 7 Despite a late evening, Jill relived as floor nurse 10 minutes early. She intended to obey Ben's order to stay out of his attempt to see the man from Mars, but she planned to be close by. Ben might need reinforcements. There were no guards in the corridor. Trays, medications, and 2 patients for surgery kept her busy for 2 hours. She had only time to check the door to Suite K-12. It was locked, as was the door to the sitting room. She considered sneaking in through the sitting room, now that the guards were gone, but had to postpone it. She was busy. Nevertheless, she kept close check on everyone who came onto her floor. Ben did not show up, and discreet questions asked of her assistant on the switchboard assured her that neither Ben nor anyone had gone into Suite K-12 while Jill was elsewhere. It puzzled her. Ben had not set a time, but he had intended to storm the Citadel early in the day. Presently, she just had to snoop. During a lull, she knocked at the door of the watchroom, stuck her head in, and pretended surprise.
"Oh, good morning, Doctor. I thought Dr. Frame was in here."
The physician at the watch desk smiled as he looked her over. "I haven't seen him, nurse. I'm Dr. Brush. Can I help?" At the typical male reaction, Jill relaxed.
"Nothing special. How is the man from Mars?"
"May?" She smiled. "It's no secret to the staff, Doctor.
Your patient,"
she gestured at the inner door.
"Huh?"
He looked startled. "Did they have him here?"
"Isn't he here now?"
"Not by 6 decimal places. Mrs. Rose Bankerson, Dr. Garner's patient. We brought her in early this morning."
"Really? What happened to the man from Mars?"
I haven't the faintest.
Say, did I really just miss seeing Valentine Smith?
He was here yesterday.
Some people have all the luck. Look what I'm stuck with.
He switched on the peeping Tom above his desk. Jill saw in it a waterbed. Floating in it was a tiny old woman.
What's her trouble?
Nurse, if she didn't have money to burn, you might call it senile dementia. As it is, she is in for rest and a checkup.
Jill made small talk, then pretended to see a call light. She went to her desk, dug out the night log.
Yes, there it was.
V.M. Smith, K-12, transfer. Below that was Rose S. Bankerson, Mrs. Red K-12. Diet kitchen instructed by Dr. Garner. No orders. Floor not responsible.
Why had they moved Smith at night?
To avoid outsiders, probably. But where had they taken him? Ordinarily, she would have called reception. But Ben's opinions, plus the phony broadcast, had made her jumpy. She decided to wait and see what she could pick up on the grapevine. But first, Jill went to the floor's public booth and called Ben. His office told her that Mr. Caxton had left town. She was startled, speechless. Then pulled herself together and left word for Ben to call. She called his home. He was not there. She recorded the same message. Ben Caxton had wasted no time. He retained James Oliver Cavendish. While any fair witness would do, the prestige of Cavendish was such that a lawyer was hardly necessary. The old gentleman had testified many times before the High Court, and it was said that the wills locked up in his head represented billions. Cavendish had received his training in total recall from the great Dr. Samuel Renshaw, and his hypnotic instruction as a fellow of the Rhine Foundation. His fee for a day was more than Ben made in a week, but Ben expected to charge it to the Post Syndicate. The best was none too good for this job. Caxton picked up the junior frisbee of Biddle Frisbee Frisbee Biddle and Reed. Then they called for witness Cavendish. The spare form of Mr. Cavendish, wrapped in the white cloak of his profession, reminded Ben of the Statue of Liberty, and was almost as conspicuous. Ben had explained to Mark Frisbee what he intended to try, and Frisbee had pointed out that he had no rights, before they called for Cavendish. Once in the fair witness's presence, they conformed to protocol and did not discuss what he might see and hear. The cab dropped them on Bethesda Center. They went down to the director's office. Ben handed in his card and asked to see the director. An imperious female asked if he had an appointment. Ben admitted that he had none.
Then your chance of seeing Dr. Bromer is very slight. Will you state your business?
Tell him, Caxton said loudly so that bystanders would hear, that Caxton of the Crow's Nest is here with a lawyer and a fair witness to interview Valentine Michael Smith, the man from Mars.
She was startled, but recovered, and said frostily,
I shall inform him. Will you be seated, please?
Thanks, I'll wait here.
Frisbee broke out a cigar. Cavendish waited with the calm patience of one who has seen all manner of good and evil. Caxton jittered. At last, the Snow Queen announced,
Mr. Berquist will see you.
Berquist? Gil Berquist?
I believe his name is Mr. Gilbert Berquist.
Caxton thought about it. Gil Berquist was one of Douglas's platoon of stooges, executive assistants.
I don't want Berquist, I want the director.
But Berquist was coming out, hand shoved out, greeter's grin on his face.
Benny Caxton, how are you, chum? Still peddling the same old hoax?
He glanced at the witness.
Same old hoax. What are you doing here, Gil? If I ever manage to get out of public service, I'm going to get me a column, too. Phone in 1,000 words a rumor and loaf the rest of the day. I envy you, Ben.
I said, what are you doing here, Gil? I want to see the director, then see the man from Mars. I didn't come here for your high-level brush-off.
Now, Ben, don't take that attitude. I'm here because Dr. Bromer has been driven frantic by the press, so the Secretary General sent me to take over the load.
Okay. I want to see Smith.
Ben, old boy, every reporter, special correspondent, feature writer, commentator, freelance, and sob sister wants that. Polly Peepers was here 20 minutes ago. She wanted to interview him on love life among the Martians.
Berquist threw up both hands.
I want to see Smith. Do I or don't I?
Ben, let's go where we can talk over a drink. You can ask me anything.
I don't want to ask you anything. I want to see Smith. This is my attorney, Mark Frisbee.
as was customary, Ben did not introduce the fair witness.
"We've met," Berquist acknowledged. "Has your father, Mark? Sinus is giving him fits."
"About the same.
This foul climate." "Come along, Ben. You too, Mark."
"Hold it," said Caxton. "I want to see Valentine Michael Smith. I'm representing the Post Syndicate and indirectly representing 200 million readers. Do I see him? If not, say so out loud and state your legal authority for refusing."
Berquist sighed.
"Mark, will you tell this keyhole historian that he can't burst into a sick man's bedroom? Smith made one appearance last night against his physician's advice. The man is entitled to peace and quiet and a chance to build up his strength."
"There are rumors," Caxton stated, "that the appearance last night was a fake."
Berquist stopped smiling.
"Frisbee," he said coldly, "do you want to advise your client concerning slander?"
"Take it easy, Ben.
I know the law on slander, Gil. But whom am I slandering? The man from Mars or somebody else? Name a name."
"I repeat," he went on, raising his voice, "that I have heard that the man interviewed on 3D last night was not the man from Mars. I want to see him and ask him."
The crowded reception hall was very quiet.
Berquist glanced at the fair witness, then got his expression under control and said smilingly,
"Ben, it's possible that you have talked yourself into an interview, as well as a lawsuit. Wait a moment."
He disappeared, came back fairly soon.
"I arranged it," he said wearily, "though you don't deserve it, Ben. Come along."
"Just you. Mark, I'm sorry, but we can't have a crowd. Smith is a sick man."
"No,"
said Caxton.
"Huh?"
"All three or none of us."
"Ben, don't be silly. You're receiving a very special privilege."
"Tell you what, Mark can come and wait outside, but you don't need him."
Berquist nodded toward Cavendish. The witness seemed not to hear.
"Maybe not, but my column will state tonight that the administration refused to permit a fair witness to see the man from Mars."
Berquist shrugged.
"Come along. Ben, I hope that slander suit clobbers you."
They took the elevator out of deference to Cavendish's age, then rode a slide away past laboratories, therapy rooms, ward after ward. They were stopped by a guard who phoned ahead and were at last ushered into a physio data display room used for watching critically ill patients.
"This is Dr. Tanner," Berquist announced. "Doctor, Mr. Caxton and Mr. Frisbee."
He did not, of course, introduce Cavendish.
Tanner looked worried. "Gentlemen, I must warn you of one thing. Don't do or say anything that might excite my patient. He is in an extremely neurotic condition and falls very easily into a state of pathological withdrawal. A trance, if you choose to call it that."
"Epilepsy?" asked Ben.
"A layman might mistake it for that. It is more like catalepsy."
"Are you a specialist, doctor? Psychiatry?"
Tanner glanced at Berquist.
"Yes," he admitted.
"Where did you do your advanced work?"
Berquist said.
"Ben, let's see the patient. You can quiz Dr. Tanner afterwards."
"Okay."
Tanner glanced over his dials, then flipped a switch and stared into a peeping Tom. He unlocked a door and led them into an adjoining bedroom, putting a finger to his lips. The room was gloomy.
"We keep it semi-darkened because his eyes are not accustomed to our light levels," Tanner explained in a hushed voice.
He went to a hydraulic bed in the center of the room.
"Mike, I've brought some friends to see you."
Caxton pressed closer. Floating, half concealed by the way his body sank into the plastic skin and covered to his armpits by a sheet, was a young man. He looked at them, but said nothing. His smooth, round face was expressionless. So far as Ben could tell, this was the man on stereo the night before. He had a sick feeling that little Jill had tossed him a live grenade, a slander suit that might bankrupt him.
"You are Valentine Michael Smith?"
"Yes."
"The man from Mars?"
"Yes."
"You were on stereo last night?"
The man did not answer. Tanner said,
"I don't think he understands.
Mike, you remember what you did with Mr. Douglas last night?"
The face looked petulant.
"Bright lights. Hurt."
"Yes, the lights hurt your eyes."
Mr. Douglas had you say hello to people. The patient smiled slightly.
Long ride in chair.
Okay, agreed Caxton. I catch on. Mike, are they treating you all right?
Yes.
You don't have to stay here. Can you walk? Tanner said hastily, Now see here, Mr. Caxton.
Berquist put a hand on Tanner's arm.
I can walk. A little. Tired.
I'll see that you have a wheelchair. Mike, if you don't want to stay here, I'll take you anywhere you want to go. Tanner shook off Berquist's hand and said, I can't have you interfering with my patient. He's a free man, isn't he? Caxton persisted. Or is he a prisoner? Berquist answered,
Of course he's free. Keep quiet, doctor. Let the fool dig his own grave.
Thanks, Gil. You heard him, Mike. You can go anywhere you like.
The patient glanced fearfully at Tanner.
No. No, no, no.
Okay, okay. Tanner snapped. Mr. Berquist, this has gone far enough.
All right, doctor.
Ben, that's enough. One more question.
Caxton thought hard, trying to think what he could squeeze out of it. Apparently Jill had been wrong. Yet she had not been wrong, or so it seemed last night.
One more question, Berquist begrudged.
Thanks. Mike, last night Mr. Douglas asked you some questions.
The patient made no comment.
Let's see. He asked you what you thought of the girls here on Earth, didn't he?
The patient's face broke into a big smile.
Gee!
Yes, Mike. When and where did you see these girls? The smile vanished. The patient glanced at Tanner, then stiffened. His eyes rolled up and he drew himself into fetal position, knees up, head bent, arms across his chest. Tanner snapped, Get out of here! He moved quickly and felt the patient's wrist.
Berquist said savagely,
That tears it! Caxton, will you get out, or shall I call the guards?
Oh, we're getting out, Caxton agreed.
All but Tanner left the room, and Berquist closed the door.
Just one point, Gil, Caxton insisted. You've got him boxed up, so just where did he see those girls?
Eh? Don't be silly, he's seen lots of girls, nurses, laboratory technicians, you know.
But I don't. I understood he had nothing but male nurses and that female visitors had been rigidly excluded.
Eh? Don't be preposterous.
Berquist looked annoyed, then suddenly grinned.
You saw a nurse with him on stereo last night.
Oh. So I did.
Caxton shut up. They did not discuss it until the three were in the air. Then Frisbee remarked,
Ben, I don't suppose the Secretary General will sue you. Still, if you have a source for that rumor, we had better perpetuate the evidence.
Forget him, Mark. He won't sue.
Ben glowered at the floor.
How do we know that was the man from Mars?
Eh? Come off it, Ben.
How do we know? We saw a man about the right age in a hospital bed. We have Berquist's word for it, and Berquist got his start in politics issuing denials. We saw a stranger supposed to be a psychiatrist, and when I tried to find out where he had studied, I got euchred out.
Mr. Cavendish, did you see anything that convinced you that this bloke was the man from Mars?
Cavendish answered,
It is not my function to form opinions. I see, I hear. That is all.
Sorry.
Are you through with me in my professional capacity?
Huh? Oh, sure. Thanks, Mr. Cavendish.
Thank you, sir. An interesting assignment.
The old gentleman took off the cloak that set him apart from ordinary mortals. He relaxed, and his features mellowed. If I'd been able to bring along a crew member of the Champion, Caxton persisted, I could have tied it down.
I must admit, remarked Cavendish, that I was surprised at one thing you did not do.
Huh? What did I miss?
Calluses.
Calluses?
Surely. A man's history can be read from his calluses. I once did a monograph on them for the Witness Quarterly. This young man from Mars, since he has never worn our sort of shoes, and has lived in gravity about one-third of ours, should display foot calluses consonant with his former environment.
Damn! Mr. Cavendish, why didn't you suggest it?
Sir,
The old man drew himself up and his nostrils dilated. I am a fair witness, sir, not a participant.
Sorry.
Caxton frowned.
Let's go back. We'll look at his feet, or I'll bust the place down.
You will have to find another witness, in view of my indiscretion in discussing it.
Yes, there's that.
Caxton frowned. Calm down, Ben, advised Frisbee. You're in deep enough. Personally, I'm convinced it was the man from Mars.
Caxton dropped them, then set the cab to hover while he thought. He had been in once, with a lawyer, with a fair witness. To demand to see the man from Mars a second time in one morning was unreasonable and would be refused. But he had not acquired a syndicated column through being balked. He intended to get in.
How?
Well, he knew where the putative man from Mars was kept.
Get in as an electrician?
Too obvious. He would never get as far as Dr. Tanner. Was Tanner a doctor? Medical men tended to shy away from hanky-panky, contrary to their code. Take that ship surgeon Nelson. He had washed his hands of the case simply because... Wait a minute. Dr. Nelson could tell whether that young fellow was the man from Mars without checking calluses or anything. Caxton tried to phone Dr. Nelson, relaying through his office since he did not know where Dr. Nelson was. Nor did Ben's assistant, Osbert Kilgallen, know, but the post-syndicate's file on important persons placed him in the New Mayflower. A few minutes later, Caxton was talking with him. Dr. Nelson had not seen the broadcast. Yes, he had heard about it. No, he had no reason to think it had been faked. Did Dr. Nelson know that an attempt had been made to coerce Smith into surrendering his rights under the Larkin decision? No, and he would not be interested if it were true. It was preposterous to talk about anyone owning Mars. Mars belonged to Martians. So? Let's propose a hypothetical question, Doctor. If someone were trying to... Dr. Nelson switched off. When Caxton tried to reconnect, a recorded voice stated, "The subscriber has suspended service temporarily, if you care to record." Caxton made a foolish statement concerning Dr. Nelson's parentage. What he did next was much more foolish. He phoned the Executive Palace, demanded to speak to the Secretary General. In his years as a snooper, Caxton had learned that secrets could often be cracked by going to the top and there making himself unbearably unpleasant. He knew that twisting the tiger's tail was dangerous. He understood the psychopathology of great power as thoroughly as Jill Boardman did not. But he relied on his position as a dealer in another sort of power, almost universally appeased. What he forgot was that, in phoning the palace from a taxicab, he was not doing so publicly. Caxton spoke with half a dozen underlings and became more aggressive with each one. He was so busy that he did not notice when his cab ceased to hover. When he did notice, it was too late. The cab refused to obey orders. Caxton realized bitterly that he had let himself be trapped by a means no hoodlum would fall for. His call had been traced, his cab identified, its robot pilot placed under orders of an overriding police frequency, and the cab was being used to fetch him in privately and with no fuss. He tried to call his lawyer. He was still trying when the taxicab landed inside a courtyard, and his signal was cut off by its walls. He tried to leave the cab, found that the door would not open, and was hardly surprised to discover that he was fast losing consciousness.
Chapter 8 Jill told herself that Ben had gone off on another scent and had forgotten to let her know, but she did not believe it. Ben owed his success to meticulous attention to human details. He remembered birthdays, and would rather have welched on a poker debt than have omitted a bread-and-butter note. No matter where he had gone, nor how urgently, he could have, would have, taken 2 minutes in the air to record a message to her. He must have left word. She called his office at her lunch break and spoke with Ben's researcher and office chief, Osbert Kilgallen. He insisted that Ben had left no message for her, nor had any come in since she had called. Did he say when he would be back? No, but we always have columns on the hook to fill in when one of these things comes up. Well, where did he call you from? Or am I being snoopy? Not at all, Miss Boardman. He did not call. It was a stat print, filed from Paoli Flat in Philadelphia. Jill had to be satisfied with that. She lunched in the nurse's dining room and picked at her food. It wasn't, she told herself, as if anything were wrong, or as if she were in love with the lunk. Hey, Boardman, snap out of the fog. Jill looked up to find Molly Wheelwright, the wing's dietitian, looking at her.
Sorry.
I said, since when does your floor put charity patients in luxury suites?
We don't.
Isn't K-12 on your floor?
K-12?
That's not charity. It's a rich old woman so wealthy that she can pay to have a doctor watch her breathe.
Humph. She must have come into money awfully suddenly. She's been in the NP ward of the geriatric sanctuary the past 17 months.
Some mistake.
Not mine. I don't allow mistakes in my kitchen. That tray is tricky. Fat-free diet and a long list of sensitivities plus concealed medication. Believe me, dear, a diet order can be as individual as a fingerprint.
Miss Wheelwright stood up.
Gotta run, chicks.
What was Molly sounding off about? A nurse asked.
Nothing. She's mixed up.
It occurred to Jill that she might locate the man from Mars by checking diet kitchens. She put the idea out of her mind. It would take days to visit them all. Bethesda Center had been a naval hospital back when wars were fought on oceans, and enormous even then. It had been transferred to health, education, and welfare and expanded. Now it belonged to the Federation and was a small city. But there was something odd about Mrs. Bankerson's case. The hospital accepted all classes of patients, private, charity, and government. Jill's floor usually had government patients, and its suites were for Federation senators or other high officials. It was unusual for a private patient to be on her floor. Mrs. Bankerson could be overflow, if the part of the center open to the fee-paying public had no suite available. Yes, probably that was it. She was too rushed after lunch to think about it, being busy with admissions. Shortly, she needed a powered bed. The routine would be to phone for one, but storage was in the basement a quarter of a mile away, and Jill wanted it at once. She recalled having seen the powered bed which belonged to K-12 parked in the sitting room of that suite. She remembered telling those Marines not to sit on it. Apparently, it had been shoved there when the flotation bed had been installed. Probably it was still there. If so, she could get it at once. The sitting room door was locked, and she found that her pass key would not open it. Making a note to tell maintenance, she went to the watchroom of the suite, intending to find out about the bed from the doctor watching Mrs. Bankerson. The physician was the one she had met before, Dr. Brush. He was not an intern nor a resident, but had been brought in for this patient, so he had said, by Dr. Garner. Brush looked up as she put her head in.
"Miss Boardman, just the person I need."
"Why didn't you ring?"
"How's your patient?"
"She's all right," he answered, glancing at the peeping Tom.
"But I am not."
"Trouble?"
"About 5 minutes worth. Nurse, could you spare me that much of your time and keep your mouth shut?"
"I suppose so. Let me use your phone and I'll tell my assistant where I am."
"No," he said urgently. "Just lock that door after I leave and don't open it until you hear me rap, shave, and a haircut. That's a good girl."
"All right, sir," Jill said dubiously. "Am I to do anything for your patient?"
"No, no, just sit and watch her in the screen. Don't disturb her."
"Well, if anything happens, where will you be? In the doctor's lounge?"
"I'm going to the men's washroom down the corridor. Now shut up, please. This is urgent."
He left, and Jill locked the door. Then she looked at the patient through the viewer and ran her eye over the dials. The woman was asleep, and displays showed pulse strong and breathing even and normal. Jill wondered why a death watch was necessary. Then she decided to see if the bed was in the far room. While it was not according to Dr. Brush's instructions, she would not disturb his patient. She knew how to walk through a room without waking a patient. And she had decided years ago that what doctors did not know rarely hurt them. She opened the door quietly and went in. A glance assured her that Mrs. Bankerson was in the typical sleep of the senile. Walking noiselessly, she went to the sitting room. It was locked, but her pass key let her in. She saw that the powered bed was there. Then she saw that the room was occupied. Sitting in a chair with a picture book in his lap was the man from Mars. Smith looked up and gave her the beaming smile of a delighted baby. Jill felt dizzy. Valentine Smith, here? He couldn't be. He had been transferred. The log showed it. Then ugly implications lined themselves up. The fake man from Mars on stereo. The old woman ready to die, but in the meantime covering the fact that there was another patient here. The door that would not open to her key, and a nightmare of the meat wagon wheeling out some night with a sheet concealing that it carried not one cadaver, but two. As this rushed through her mind, it carried fear, awareness of peril through having stumbled onto this secret. Smith got clumsily up from his chair, held out both hands, and said,
"Water, brother."
Hello? How are you?
I am well. I am happy. He added something in a strange, choking speech, corrected himself, and said carefully, You are here, my brother. You were away. Now you are here. I drink deep of you.
Jill felt herself helplessly split between emotions, one that melted her heart, and icy fear of being caught. Smith did not notice. Instead, he said,
See, I walk, I grow strong.
He took a few steps, then stopped, triumphant, breathless, and smiling. She forced herself to smile.
We are making progress, aren't we? You keep growing stronger, that's the spirit. But I must go, I just stopped to say hello.
His expression changed to distress.
Do not go.
Oh, I must.
He looked woebegone, then added with tragic certainty,
I have hurted you. I did not know.
Hurt me? Oh, no, not at all, but I must go. And quickly.
His face was without expression. He stated rather than asked,
Take me with you, my brother.
What? Oh, I can't. And I must go at once. Look, don't tell anyone I was here, please.
Not tell them my water brother was here?
Yes, don't tell anyone. I'll come back. You be a good boy and wait, and don't tell anyone.
Smith digested this, looked serene.
I will wait. I will not tell.
Good. Jill wondered how she could keep her promise. She realized now that the broken lock had not been broken, and her eye went to the corridor door and saw why she had not been able to get in. A hand bolt had been screwed to the door. As was always the case, bathroom doors and other doors that could be bolted were arranged to open also by pass key so the patients could not lock themselves in. Here the lock kept Smith in, and a bolt of the sort not permitted in hospitals kept out even those with pass keys. Jill opened the bolt.
You wait. I'll come back.
I shall wait.
When she got back to the watchroom, she heard the tock-tock-ta-tock-tock, tock-tock signal that Brush had said he would use. She hurried to let him in. He burst in, saying savagely, Where were you, nurse? I knocked 3 times! He glanced suspiciously at the inner door.
I saw your patient turn over, she lied quickly. I was arranging her collar pillow.
Damn it, I told you simply to sit at my desk. Jill knew suddenly that the man was frightened. She counterattacked.
Doctor, she said coldly, your patient is not my responsibility, but since you entrusted her to me, I did what seemed necessary since you questioned it. Let's get the wing superintendent.
Huh? No. Forget it. No, sir. A patient that old can smother in a waterbed. Some nurses will take any blame from a doctor, but not me. Let's call the superintendent.
What?
Look, Miss Boardman, I popped off without thinking. I apologize.
Very well, doctor.
Jill answered stiffly.
Is there anything more?
No, thank you. Thanks for standing by for me. Well, be sure not to mention it, will you?
I won't mention it.
You bet your sweet life I won't.
But what do I do now? Oh, I wish Ben were in town. She went to her desk and pretended to look over papers. Finally, she remembered to phone for the powered bed she had been after. Then she sent her assistant on an errand and tried to think. Where was Ben? If he were in touch, she would take 10 minutes relief, call him, and shift the worry onto his broad shoulders. But Ben, damn him, was off sky-oodling and letting her carry the ball. Or was he? A fret that had been burrowing in her subconscious finally surfaced. Ben would not have left town without letting her know the outcome of his attempt to see the man from Mars. As a fellow conspirator, it was her right, and Ben always played fair. She could hear in her head something he had said.
If anything goes wrong, you are my ace in the hole. Honey, if you don't hear from me, you are on your own.
She had not thought about it at the time, as she had not believed that anything could happen to Ben. Now she thought about it. There comes a time in the life of every human when he or she must decide to risk his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor on an outcome dubious. Jill Boardman encountered her challenge and accepted it at 3:47 that afternoon. The man from Mars sat down when Jill left. He did not pick up the picture book.
but simply waited, in a fashion which may be described as patient only because human language does not embrace Martian attitudes. He held still with quiet happiness, because his brother had said that he would return. He was prepared to wait without moving, without doing anything, for several years.